Let's go ahead and get started. Chapter 11. We're going to move through chapter 11, starting in verse 5. Go ahead and have your intertestamental chronology chart by your side. It's going to become very useful, unless you just have an incredibly organized mind. If I didn't have these notes in front of me, I don't know what kind of circumstance I'd be in. This gets pretty hairy here, about verses 5 to 19. We're not going to be looking at all of chapter 11 by any stretch of the imagination. If we make it to verse 19, we'll be doing really good. I want to stop, though, at some point, maybe when we've got, 10, 15 minutes left, and take a peek at the end of chapter 12, at that 1290 and 1335, because I think there's some of you who are interested in hearing about that. So I want to leave a little bit of time for that. But enough introduction. Let's go ahead and get to verse 5, where our first part of the 11th chapter dealt with things we were familiar with, the Persians and the Medes and the Greek Empire under Alexander. But starting in verse 5, we see this division between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. We did look at 5 yesterday, but let's do it again. Also, the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Please wave me down if we start moving too fast, because I know the speed we have moved at sometimes that may not be very helpful at this point. All right. The king of the south here, I think, is going to be the very first Seleucid king on your chart here. Seleucus the first, Nicator. Anybody happen to remember what Nicator meant? Conqueror, victor, yes. And that's because he was. He extended the kingdom of the Seleucid, the then beginning Seleucid kingdom, much more than the Ptolemaic kingdom down south. And by the way, I mentioned to you yesterday that you can be writing these additional names these men had on the, you know, you can write it to the, here's how I do it. Over to the right-hand side, like Seleucus first, then I'll write Nicator. And then over on the left, I write the verse number that that man pertains to. And that's kind of just a helpful way of keeping things in track. You do what you want to do. But next to Seleucus the first, over on the right, I have Nicator. On the left, I have verse 5. And I have verse 5 to the left of Ptolemy Soter over there on the right. Because Ptolemy Soter is the king of the south, and Nicator is one of his princes. Nicator had been a satrap. He had been a general of Ptolemy's. That's why he's called one of his princes. But he had gotten that kingdom up there in the north. He did gain power over Ptolemy in that the Seleucid kingdom was much larger. His dominion was a great dominion, it says here. Now verse 6. At the end of some years, they shall join forces. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the daughter of the king of the north, to the king of the north, to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. There's heaps there. All right. Number one, we're going to move to the next kings already. The king of the south here in verse 6 has already transitioned. Ptolemy Philadelphus comes to power in 285. You see him right here. He comes after Soter. Ptolemy's the second. Philadelphus, he reigns from 285 to 247. He is the king of the south in verse 6. Now, up in the north, Antiochus Thoas has succeeded to the throne. And we went past Seleucus Nicator. I'm sorry, I'm getting confused here. We went past Antiochus the first Soter. And so verse 6 is going to be Antiochus Thoas for the Seleucids. So the king of the north, Antiochus Thoas. The king of the south is Ptolemy Philadelphus here in verse 6. Now they're going to join forces. That's how my New King James words it. What there is going to happen is going to be an alliance here. Other translations bear that out. There had been war between these two kings, but the results had been indecisive, and there was this uneasy peace concluded in 252 B.C., which ends up resulting in this alliance. Yes, Kathy?
What is that second word you are saying?
Oh, I'm sorry. What I'm doing, I'm saying Thaos. You can say Theos. I'm getting that from what I learned how to pronounce Greek words. Theos. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't tell you that. Antiochus the second. Okay, sorry. I've got to remember to do that. I've got them written here. Why don't you? Antiochus, okay, Seleucus the first is Nicator. Antiochus the first under him is Soter. Sorry. And then Antiochus the second is Theos or Theos. Okay, this one plays no role in the prophecies we have. We just pass right on by him. And verse 6, Antiochus the second Theos is the king of the north. Are we all on the same page? Sure, yes, Tom?
Which one of the Ptolemies was Ptolemy the Great? Was that the first one?
Ptolemy the Great? I don't know. I don't know that I've come across that title, so I can't say.
I haven't written Ptolemy the Great, so
okay.
Maybe the same.
Did you have something, Tom?
I'm thinking that's correct.
Okay. Now, do we have any other questions? Because if this is like an algebra equation. If you don't get one line, the rest of it's shot. Yes, Keith.
Can we suggest you just give us all the names now?
Okay. Good idea.
You don't have to remember it.
All right, good idea. Seleucus the second. Let's start with the Seleucids. We go Nicator, Soter, Theos, and then Seleucus the second is Callinicus. Now, I know you're like, why are we writing this? But it's a little easier than Antiochus II, Seleucus II. That gets really confusing. And then Seleucus III, all right, so after Callinicus, Seleucus II, Callinicus, you have Seleucus III, who's named Coronus. That's thunderer, but of course, apparently he wasn't much of a thunderer. And then Antiochus III is the great. And if we get there, we're going to spend a lot of time with him. Okay. We all together? Okay. All right. Okay. That was a good idea, Keith. Thank you. All right. So the king of the south in verse 6 is Ptolemy the second, Philadelphus. This guy's a memorable figure. He's a bibliophile. He loves books. He's bringing in books from all over the world. He's the main impetus, or one of the strong impetuses anyway, behind the Alexandrian Library. He's the one who commissioned the translation of the Septuagint. So he's a memorable figure. We read here that at the end of some years, let me reread that verse now, they shall join forces. So the king of the north, king of the south, Ptolemy Philadelphus and Antiochus Theos are going to make this alliance. And the alliance comes in the form of the daughter of the king of the south. Ptolemy Philadelphus' daughter, her name is Berenice. Oh. Looks like that thing was...
I'm glad you guys were seeing that. I'm not just me.
Is that a distraction?
Very much so.
What can we do? Okay. Hey. Thank you. All right. War had broken out between these two kings. They get this peace underway in 252, but then they make this alliance, and what happens is Ptolemy Philadelphus sends his daughter up to Antiochus Theos to marry him. This is a completely political marriage. There's no amorous relationship here that I'm aware of at all. It's a political marriage. Ptolemy Philadelphus is trying to establish a permanent peace and alliance between the two countries. But there's a problem. Berenice is sent up there to marry Antiochus Theos, but Antiochus Theos already has a wife, a woman by the name of Laodice. You can say however you want to say it. Oh, it might be. I actually think... Okay. Why am I teaching this? You guys already know this stuff. To review?
To teach one another.
Right. Tegasthius rebuilt the city and called it Laodicea.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Now... Antiochus Theos and Laodice have two sons. But the deal is, Philadelphia says, all right, you get my daughter Berenice as wife, but you're going to have to divorce Laodice, and those two sons cannot have to be heirs to the throne. Now, what benefit does this have for Ptolemy Philadelphus? Well, the deal is, if Berenice and Thoas have a child, then he's heir to the throne, and that means Philadelphus then has a family connection to the northern kingdom, which sounds real good to him. So the marriage does take place. Antiochus Thoas divorces Laodice and marries Berenice. They do have a son, and then something goes wrong for Philadelphus. He dies. He dies in 247 BC. Now, this was a political marriage. So if you're Antiochus Thoas, you're the king of the north here, you married her for political reasons, and the guy down there has passed away, what do? Well, being the kind of man he was, you divorce her and you go back to your first wife. So he divorces Berenice, and he goes back to Laodice. And notice what it says here in verse 6, she shall not retain the power of her authority. Berenice for a time is queen. Now she's been divorced. And not only that, she ends up being killed by one of those other two sons, Laodice's sons. Now, I hope this is not getting confusing. Laodice has been taken back by Antiochus to us. She knows what kind of man she's married to. I was married to him before and he dumped me. Well, I'm not going to let that happen again, and she has him killed. So, Antiochus Thoas is dead now. That might be what's meant there. Neither he nor his authority shall stand. Either that's Ptolemy Philadelphus who has now died, or it's Antiochus Thoas who's now been killed. But all those men are out of the way. Berenice has lost her authority. Philadelphus is dead. Antiochus Thoas has been killed. And then it says here in verse 6, she, that's Berenice, she shall be given up. Yes? She ends up being murdered by the man who's going to succeed in Antiochus Thoas' place, Callinicus, Seleucus II, Callinicus. We could break down that verse more, but let's move on to verse 7. All right. But from a branch of her roots, this is Berenice's roots, but from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them, and prevail. One of the shoots that came from her roots, someone from her family, from her stock, is going to arise in his place, Ptolemy Philadelphus' place. And that man is her brother, Ptolemy III, Euergetes, who you see there right after Ptolemy Philadelphus. He reigns from 247 to 222. And Ptolemy Euergetes is the king of the south in verses 7 and 8. Verses 7 and 8. All right. Ptolemy Euergetes is informed of what's going on up there with his sister. She calls down to him and she says, I need some help putting my son on the throne. He hears of the calamity that's befallen her. And so he heads north with a great force out of Egypt to defend and rescue her. But he doesn't get there in time. He shows up and she's been killed. So, what's he do? Well, he deals with them and prevails. Euergetes actually ends up joining forces with another army that's coming out of Asia Minor, and with their help, he accomplishes a series of brilliant victories up in the northern kingdom. He makes himself master of Syria, of Cilicia. He passes over the Euphrates River. He brought all under subjection to him as far as the Tigris River. This, by the way, is called the Laodicean War. It was about 5 years, from 246 to 241 BC. And during this time that Euergetes is up there, the shoot from Berenice's roots, while he's up there doing all this conquering, somewhere along this line, during or after, Laodice gets her just deserts, and she is put to death. Now, Euergetes is having tremendous success up there, but he stops. He doesn't finish the job. He doesn't conquer the whole north because he gets word that there's a sedition in Egypt. So he heads back to Egypt, otherwise he might have conquered the whole northern kingdom, and on his way back to Egypt, verse 8 picks up. He shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Jerome tells us that when Ptolemy Euergetes goes back to Egypt, he takes with himself 40,000 talents of silver, a vast number of precious vessels of gold, and along with it, 2,400 idols. 2,400 Egyptian idols, which is so interesting. These were idols that Cambyses, the Persian king, all the way back there, when he had come and conquered Egypt, he had taken these idols, he had taken them up to that part of the world. Euergetes gets these, brings them back down to Egypt, and of course, what do the Egyptians think? This is fantastic. We've got our gods back, they're put back in the temple or temples, and that's where he gets the name Euergetes, which means benefactor. So just like the prophecy says, he comes back with the gods. The New King James says princes there, but other translations say metal images, molded images. He comes back with these images. He comes back with the silver and gold, 40,000 talents of silver, these precious articles of gold. And he does continue, as the end of the verse says, more years than the king of the north. Because if you look there on your intertestamental chronology there, Ptolemy Euergetes reigns until 222. Seleucus Callinicus only reigns to 226. So he outlasts him 4 years, just like the prophecy says. Are we together so far? Those who want to be together. Some of you may wrote this whole thing off. Okay, verse 9. Also, the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the south, to the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. Now, verse 9, if you're reading out of the King James, sounds very different than what I just read to you. In the King James Version, the king of the south is the subject of the sentence. It reads, the king of the south shall come into his kingdom. Young's literal does the same thing. The king of the south shall come into the kingdom. And if that's the right translation, then probably what you may have here is just a summary of what was just said. Euergetes goes up into the north and goes into that kingdom. However, most of the other translations render it the other way, that the king of the north is the one who comes into the kingdom of the south. Euergetes goes up there and he does all this conquering. Callinicus does not stand for it. He does mount a counter-assault, and he succeeds in regaining the territories he lost, at least as far as Damascus. Now, Israel remains in Ptolemaic control, but Callinicus does get all the way back down to the areas of Damascus on this counter-assault. And I think that might be what verse 9 is about. And then he does return to his own land, because he proceeds to march against Ptolemy and gets soundly defeated. Peace is concluded between these two powers in 240 B.C., All right. Now, it's going to get a little easier starting here in verse 10, because verses 10 through 19, the king of the north is going to be the same king the whole time. It's going to be this man right here, Antiochus III the Great. From verses 10 to 19, he is always the king of the north. And he is a significant historical figure. Does anyone remember who his son is? Epiphanes. Epiphanes is the one we spent so much time on in chapter 8, and the one that this chapter actually later spends a great deal of time on. He is Antiochus III, the great son. Antiochus 15 was actually Antiochus IV. Alright, so starting now in verse 10, the king of the north is always going to be Antiochus III, and we're only going to have two kings of the south. The first one's going to be Philopater, that you have there from 222 to 205. If you're writing these down, Philopater, the Ptolemaic king, the fourth one down, he is the king in verses 11 and 12. Ptolemy the fourth, Philopater, or Philopater, is the king of the south in verses 11 and 12. And then Ptolemy the fifth, Epiphanes, verses 13 through 15, cover his time period. Verses 13 through 17. Okay. Antiochus III is going to set the stage for Antiochus Epiphanes, because Antiochus the Great, or the Third, is going to conquer Palestine and put it under Seleucid control. That way, as a result of that, Antiochus Epiphanes is going to come along and, of course, wreak havoc on the Jews. So, with that in mind, verse 10, we know who the king of the north is, and the king of the south we're starting with is Ptolemy Philopater. Verse 10. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. All right. The his is Seleucus Callinicus. His is the king of the north here. His sons are going to stir up strife. And he's got two sons. And move through this slowly. If you look there at Callinicus, you see his two sons there. Seleucus Coronus, right here. And then Antiochus the Great. Those both are Callinicus' sons. Coronus and the Great. Now, when Callinicus dies and Coronus assumes the throne, Antiochus the Great is just a general. So you have Coronus as king, Antiochus the Great as general, and they do work together to wage to battle Egypt. But if you look there at Coronus, he doesn't reign very long. After about 3 years, he dies. And notice how verse 10 was worded. I know if you're reading out of the NIV, you don't see this, but in verse 10, notice, we start with the plural. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, but then what? And one shall certainly come and overwhelm. That's because Coronus dies, leaving Antiochus the Great to assume the throne, and then Antiochus is the one who carries out all the exploits up to verse 19. 223 BC, Antiochus the Great comes to power. Now, he does overwhelm and pass through. Notice the language in verse 10. One shall certainly come, not go, shall come. This language seems like it may suggest that from the standpoint of a Jew, he's going to come into Palestine and he's going to pass through. And history confirms this. And I'm going to give it in three phases. Antiochus the Great in 221. He crushes a revolt in the eastern part of his empire and then he attempts an invasion of Palestine in the summer of 221 BC. He doesn't get very far. But he doesn't stop. 219 BC, he makes another attempt on Palestine, and this time, Ptolemy's commander-in-chief, Theodotus, this is Ptolemy's commander-in-chief of the armed forces, Theodotus is the one who had thwarted Antiochus in 221, but this time in 219, Theodotus defects and goes over and lines himself up with Antiochus, which becomes very helpful. And Antiochus then is able to make further progress. And in the spring of 217 BC, there have been some skirmishes in between, but in the spring of 217 BC, Antiochus the Great has conquered all of the Promised Land, and he's even gone a little farther into the Egyptian frontier. All right, so... What was that? 217. Spring of 217 BC, Antiochus the Great has conquered all of the Promised Land, and he's down now in the Egyptian frontier. Now the next phrase in verse 10 is, he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. That's how my New King James words it. Other translations render it differently. He may again wage war up to his very fortress, again carry out war as far as his fortress, carry the battle as far as his fortress. I think those may be better translations. It's easier to match up with the history based on what I know. Antiochus, as I said, gets all the way down to the frontiers of Egypt, and he gets just south of the town of Raphia. I'm just writing all these things up here. Raphia is an Egyptian fortress on the frontier. It's a frontier fortress, and a battle ensues there. Antiochus would come this far, just south of it, but no farther. At Raphia in the spring of 217 BC, a decisive battle is fought between Antiochus the Great and that next king of Egypt, Ptolemy Philopater, who's mentioned there, and he's the fourth one down. Ptolemy Philopater had assumed the throne in 222. So we have this battle between Ptolemy Philopater and Antiochus the Great in 217 BC, down there south of Raphia, and Antiochus experiences a disastrous defeat. The battle starts out well for him, but it doesn't end well. Let me read this to you. Now this is written in kind of old English, but bear with me. The event of the battle was Antiochus, commanding the right wing, routed the opposite wing of the enemy. But pursuing them too far in the interim, The other wing of the enemy, that's Philopater, having beaten his left wing, fell upon the main body, then left naked, and utterly broke them before he could return to their assistance. An old officer of Antiochus' army, observing which way the cloud of the dust went, concluded from that the main body was routed and showed it to the king. But although he immediately returned, Antiochus came too late to recover this fault, finding all the rest of his army put to flight on his coming back to them. He was forced to retreat, first to Raphia and next to Gaza, with the loss of 10,000 of his men slain and 4,000 taken prisoner, after which he was no more able to make headway against Ptolemy in those parts. He quitted them to the conqueror, and having gathered together the reins of his broken forces, he returned with them to Antioch. So, looking at verse 11, I think that might go with this. The king of the south is moved with rage. This is Ptolemy Philopater, if we're understanding this right. Antiochus has come down. I hope I'm not confusing. Ptolemy Euergetes had gone up in defense and in response to Berenice, had done all that conquering. Antiochus is reconquering it again. And Ptolemy Philopater comes out in rage and says, No, you've taken all this. You're not taking any more. Meets him in battle in 217, in the spring of 217. Whips him and sends Antiochus headed back. He goes out and fights, verse 11. And the king of the north musters this great multitude. When Antiochus came to battle, he had 62,000 infantry. He had 6,000 cavalry, 102 elephants. But we just saw he loses 10,000 infantry. He has 4,000 taken prisoner. And that's what we're seeing here in verse 11. The multitude is given into the hand of his enemy. This multitude that Antiochus had is given in to Ptolemy Philopater, and he wins. He lost 300 cavalry and 5 elephants too. So losing elephants would be a big deal. Multiple ways. Verse 12. When he has taken away the multitude, now this is Ptolemy Philopater. He defeated Antiochus. He took prisoner 4,000 and killed 10,000. He takes this multitude, and his heart will be lifted up, verse 12, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. After the multitude of Antiochus has been given into the hand of Ptolemy Philopater, his heart is lifted up. Meaning, he gets proud. He gets proud. Hey, I look at this great victory. He casts down tens of thousands, but he doesn't prevail. What would a good general do? A good, what would be considered a good king in the eyes of the world, what would he do if he had a smashing victory out on his frontier against his enemy who had been conquering his land? What would he do? He'd keep pushing, wouldn't he? I've just taken 10,000, I've got 4,000 prisoners, I'm going to keep pushing this guy out of here. But that's not what he does. After he has this victory at Raphia, he just goes back to Egypt and starts living it up. And he's a very profligate man. I mean, there's stuff this man's involved in that we're better off not talking about here. Very, very wicked man. He was wholly given up to luxury and sloth. He returned immediately after his victory into Egypt, surrendered himself up to the enjoyment of his pleasures. He concludes a truce with Antiochus. And what are the people of Egypt thinking? What are you doing? They're not happy about this at all. In fact, his conduct after his victory ends up prompting a rebellion on the part of the Egyptians. And one source I consulted just pointed out that because of the way he behaves after the victory, he ultimately is less able to wage a war after his victory than he was before. Perhaps because of the people's response. He dies in 205 BC. This is Philopater. He dies in 205 BC without ever having built up his strength or his fortifications like he could have, and from a military standpoint, like he should have. Now, I know we're throwing out lots of names, but you see how this is all flowing together. One event is just leading to another, to another, to another. A play by play. And you can see why the skeptic is saying, I don't like the looks of this. If you don't want God in your life, you don't like the looks of this, because this is just beautifully matching up intricately with what history reveals to us. Let's look at verse 13 now. That's 217, wasn't it?
Yes.
Thank you. 217. All right, verse 13. For the king of the north will return. We're still with Antiochus the Great now. He hightailed it back to Antioch, but he's going to return. The king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former. He had a big army last time. He's going to have a bigger one this time. And shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. While Ptolemy Philopator is living it up down there in Egypt, Antiochus the Great is earning his name. He's a busy man. He's successfully fighting battles in the east, and he's making plans to annex Palestine. Philopator dies at a young age. He dies in 182 BC. He's not a very old man. And one author I was reading attributes that to the way he lived. And you know, a sinful life is hard on the body. I've had the experience in Colorado a couple of times working in a neighborhood that, you know, it's a pretty tough neighborhood. There's prostitution in the neighborhood. There's drugs in the neighborhood. Lots of alcohol in the neighborhood. And one of my trips out there, I think it may have been the same trip, I had two people remark to me that, "You look healthy." And, you know, in our middle class world, there's nothing outstanding about my appearance by any stretch of the imagination. But I think in their world, by the time somebody gets to 35 and 36, it's not uncommon for him to look pretty bad. He's drunk and drunk and drunk. He's shot up and shot up and smoked and done all sorts of things, and it shows. And my life's been very easy in comparison to that. And it's just interesting. I mean, I had one man ask me, "How old are you?" I told him, and then he remarks, you know, something like that. "Well, you look good, or you look healthy." Just interesting. And here's a man who had maybe a strong body, but kills himself with profligate living, possibly. And then Ptolemy the Fifth Epiphanes now. He comes to power, and he's going to be the king of the south up at least till verse 17. Ptolemy Epiphanes is only 4 or 5 when he comes to power. And if you're Antiochus, and you got whipped by Philopator down there, but you still want in Palestine, and you learn that he's dead, and his 4 or 5-year-old son has come to king, what kind of thoughts do you start having? Now's my chance. So that's what he does. Antiochus, king of Syria, and Philip, king of Macedon. Now, this, of course, this is long after Alexander. But Antiochus, king of Syria, and Philip, king of Macedon, thinking to serve themselves of the advantage they had at the death of Philopator and the succession of an infant king after him, entered into a league to divide his dominions between them. So Antiochus the Great now marches into what's called Seal Syria, maybe the southern Syria area. He marches into Palestine, partly in 203 BC, and then partly the next year, if I'm getting those dates right. And he makes himself master of all those provinces and the districts and so forth. So he gets what he wants. He gets down there and he gets Palestine. And this does come at the end of some years, just as the verse said. It said, at the end of some years, he'll come with a great army and much equipment. The battle at Raphia had been in what year? 217. This is now about 203, 202, if I've got my dates right. So 14 years have passed that he's now making this new attempt. And he did come with a great army and much equipment, a better equipped army than he had before. Any comments up to verse 13? Yes, Tom.
One thing that happens with all these battles is that God's people are right in the middle.
Yes.
Whenever they march north, they go through Israel, and when they come south, they go through Israel. So they're really oppressed during this period of time because of just the invading armies going through.
Thank you. And that is the big picture here, that in the middle of all the details, we should remember. God has placed His people not in some obscure corner of the world. He placed them right in the middle of everything. I think there's probably a lesson there. But yeah, that's why this is so important. I mean, Will Durant calls this dead history. I mean, we care because it's in Daniel 11. But were it not for Daniel 11, would we be reading this stuff? Maybe some of us would. Most of us wouldn't. Most of us don't now. And we'd even have less reason to do it then. But this mattered a lot to the Jewish people. That's right. And they're being very affected by all this back and forth like a tug of war. Yes. Anything else?
John,
Tom?
Is there a lot of Greek speaking going on right now?
I would think so. I don't have any source anything I can draw on to prove that right at the moment, though. The question was, is there a lot of Greek speaking going on at this point? So
it's not what Alexander the Great
Yeah, but that doesn't happen overnight. I don't know how long it took that to really take hold.
All these four generals would have been Greek speakers. And so I wonder if they're passing their influence down as bleeding.
Well, I would definitely think the influence is at work. I just don't know to what extent so far. Yeah. Okay. Verse 13. The king of the north will return and muster a greater multitude. Oh, we read that. Verse 14. Now in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. All right, so Antiochus has come down. He has conquered the southern Syria. He has conquered Palestine. Now it says, in those times, verse 14, so maybe around the same period of time, many now are going to rise up. In other words, it's not just going to be Antiochus the Great against Ptolemy Epiphanes down there. There are many. Philip of Macedon is one. There's this fellow down in Egypt by the name of Agathocles that he has excited a rebellion in Egypt. There is a man by the name of Scopas, who is a commander of the Egyptian armies, but he has laid a plot against Ptolemy Epiphanes. That might be part of all this. Somewhere along, at some point he did that. It got thwarted, but there are a number of sources bearing down now on the Ptolemaic kingdom. And there's one more group of people mentioned here in verse 14. It says violent men. I know your King James says robbers there. But most of the translations just carry the idea of violent, children of the violent, violent ones, violent men. Daniel is told these are violent people, violent men what? Of your people. So we're looking at Jews here. That these Jewish people are going to line up with these others against the kingdom of the Ptolemies. They're going to exalt themselves. The NIV just says rebel. They're under the power of the Ptolemies. Now we're kind of backtracking for just a moment. The Jews are under the power of the Ptolemies, but apparently they like the idea of being under the power of Antiochus better. At least some of them. At least they give that appearance. Because when Antiochus is making those victories in Celsyria and then has his victory in Samaria, he comes down to where the Jews are and they have him right in. The Jews, of their own accord, Josephus says, went over to him, received him into Jerusalem, gave him plentiful provision to his army and to his elephants, and readily assisted him when he besieged the garrison which was in the citadel of Jerusalem. When he comes in to conquer, they say, come on in. Let us help. Let us feed your animals. What can we do for you? And in so doing, they are betraying Ptolemy Epiphanes down there, who at least at present was their king. And for a while, it must have looked like their plan was working wonderfully. Antiochus starts saying wonderful things about him. He starts sending letters. He ends up making at least some of them exempt from taxes to a point. Helps him out. Eventually, notice how the verse ends in verse 14. They'll exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision. Not that they're trying to fulfill the vision, but by helping Antiochus, they're going to prompt the fulfillment of this vision. What does it say at the end? They shall fall. That Scopas, that Egyptian general, later he comes with a great army from Ptolemy, and while Antiochus is engaged in other parts, he subdues the Jews, places guards on the coast of Jerusalem, and returns with great spoils to Egypt. So this move on their part, I don't know if they were just trying to get under Antiochus or if they were thinking, well, if we can get under Antiochus, then maybe we can work through him to get our independence. Whatever their goal was, they ended up paying a price for what they did, for lining themselves up with these other powers against the power in Egypt. All right, verse 15. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. Okay. Now the king of the north again is who? Antiochus the Great. It says he's going to build a siege mound and take a fortified city. All right. In 198 BC, for you date lovers, in 198 BC, that Egyptian general Scopas meets with Antiochus in battle. And they meet at a place called Peneus. Scopas is decisively defeated, 198 BC, And he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. He hightails out of Peneus and goes over to Sidon, a fortified city. And there with 10,000 of his soldiers, he holds himself up. Antiochus follows him there and besieges the city by land and by sea. Build up a siege mound. Looks like these things may fit together. Now, what's it say here in verse 15? The forces of the south, what? Shall not withstand him. They, of course, were defeated at Peneus, but then they're holed up in Sidon. And if you're in a siege, what becomes one of your biggest concerns? Food. There's a famine. So just at a time when you would need food even under good circumstances, potentially, there's a famine. And Scopas ends up having to surrender. But Scopas wasn't the only one involved. Notice what it says in verse 15. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. Even the choice troops shall have no strength to resist. Let me write some names up here on the whiteboard. I'm going to write three names. What ends up happening is, down in Egypt, they hear about what's happened to Scopas, and so they send some help. And they send three of their best generals. A man by the name of Aeropas. Another man by the name of Menecles. And a third one by the name of Demosthenes. Now, these are three of their best generals. They send them up there with a select group of soldiers to help Scopas, who's holed up in Sidon, or who, at least who will be. Somewhere along the line, they're sent up there to help, but they're not able to help. They are not able to deliver Scopas, and they end up returning to Egypt. So even the choice ones are not able to defeat Antiochus. So that fits with what we see in verse 16. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. Antiochus the Great comes against Scopas, and he is able to do according to his will. Not Scopas, not those generals, not the soldiers are able to withstand. And so now, what is Antiochus able to do? Stand where? In the beautiful land, which of course is Israel. He's now victorious in Palestine. He stands there with sure power, with destruction in his power, my New King James says. In his hand shall be destruction. He will have power to destroy. Not that he does destroy, but he has the authority to do so. You know a man has full authority over a group of people when he has power to destroy them. So he has his power now is established. He's driven back the Egyptian forces, the best that they had, and now the Seleucid kingdom has the kingdom of, has Palestine under their control. What can happen next? Verse 17. Now we're talking about Antiochus. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom. Where would he want to enter? Now he's already got Palestine now. He's already got Jerusalem. So where do you think he would want to enter now? Egypt. Sure. That would be one logical conclusion. All right, I've got all this. I've broken their best. I think I may just invade Egypt and take the whole thing. Now we want to notice the language carefully. He shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus he shall do it. At the very least, he's going to set his face to do it. He's going to determine to do it. But notice, he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. Remember Jesus in Luke 9:51, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. When you set your face to do something, you make a determination, a resolve, this is what I'm going to do. This may be describing Antiochus the Great's train of thought, that this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go down there and invade Egypt, but it doesn't come to pass. And one more thing though, he's going to enter with what? How's it worded there in verse 17? If he's going to invade Egypt, and when he does, he's going to enter with what? The strength of his whole kingdom. I am not a World War II historian. But as I understand it, one of the reasons that the bombs were dropped is because of the huge losses that were going to be incurred in invading Japan. You know, you can fight a people outside their country, but when you come into their country, to try to take them. That's serious business. And if it's a kingdom that has any power at all, they can entrench themselves and they're going to fight tooth and nail. So if you're going to try to go in and invade the Ptolemaic kingdom, it's going to take everything you got. So he's thinking of putting the whole kingdom into it, perhaps, and he's going to have upright ones with him. Notice it says, this word upright ones is from the same root as Jeshurun is. What's Jeshurun? Another name for Israel. Deuteronomy 32, 15 and other places. So it looks like, if we're getting this right, that Antiochus thought, okay, I'm going to go down and invade Egypt, I'm going to take my whole kingdom, and the Jews are going to come with me. They're going to help me fight. After all, they helped me down there in Jerusalem. They fed my elephants and so forth. So I can count on their help as well. But he doesn't do it. He doesn't do it. His determination to invade Egypt, if we're understanding that right, ends up being set aside because he's contemplating war with somebody else. Anybody want to take a guess? It's Rome. He's contemplating war with Rome. Antiochus the Great wants to extend the borders of the Seleucid kingdom to where they were in the days of Nicator, that first king who had the great dominion. He wants to have all that power over there in Asia Minor and so forth. And to get it, he's going to have to fight Rome. And so he makes this interesting decision. Well, one more thing. Rome by this time has defeated Hannibal. And that gets Rome a lot of fame. And Egypt, the Ptolemies down in Egypt, have called upon Rome and they have said, we'd like your protection and we'd like your help against Antiochus. Now, if you're Antiochus, the last thing you need is war with the Romans and the Ptolemies. Give me one, but don't give me both. So Antiochus may have wanted to neutralize the power, the threat in Egypt, so that he could attack the Roman area. So how are you going to do that? Tom, did you have something you wanted to say? Okay. Yeah. If you want to neutralize the power down there in Egypt, you're going to have to offer him something. I mean, well, the last thing he needs is to be over here fighting Rome and then to find out the Egyptians are marching right up and taking his territory. So I need to know that they're not going to do that. So he does, I think that's maybe what's going on here. So he gives the king of Egypt, Ptolemy Epiphanes, the daughter of women, who is his daughter, named Cleopatra. But not the Cleopatra we are so familiar with. There were some seven Cleopatras. The Cleopatra we know is Cleopatra the seventh, Philopater. So not the same woman. But this is the daughter of Antiochus. And he sends her down there. And this, of course, is a political move. She's called the daughter of women. Perhaps because she was noticeably beautiful, or perhaps because she was the princess or heir to the throne, heiress to the throne. But he arranges a political marriage now. Okay, Ptolemy Epiphanes, I'm going to give you my daughter. But Ptolemy Epiphanes is still a young man. He's not even a young man, maybe. I mean, he's only around 13. He's not ready for marriage yet. But they make the contract in 197 B.C. In 197 B.C., the contract is made that Ptolemy Epiphanes is going to marry Cleopatra. Now, what's in this for Egypt? I mean, they've called upon help from Rome. Rome's a pretty sweet deal. Why make this arrangement with the Seleucid king, who you've been fighting with in all this? Well, everyone's got to give on a deal like this. Okay, you marry my daughter, and don't bother me, may have been part of the deal, and you can have Palestine and this Seal Syria area. Now, we'll divide the revenues, but you'll get that. All right? They like that deal down in Egypt, so the deal is made. The contract in 197, and then the marriage finally takes place in 193 BC, while Ptolemy... Never mind. The marriage takes place in 193 BC. All right. Now, depending on your translation, let's notice how verse 17 is worded again. He shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus he shall do, and he shall give him, give Ptolemy Epiphanes, the daughter of women, that's Cleopatra, to destroy it. I think your King James says corrupting her. Now some think, well, that means he's corrupting his daughter. You know, he's filling her with all his ideas and his schemes, and he sends her down there. Well, that may be right. Although some of your translations reflect that the thing he's going to corrupt or destroy is the country itself. In other words, he's not just making a deal here where I'm trying to keep Egypt off my back. That he may have had plans that through my daughter, I'm going to bring Egypt down. All right, honey, here's our deal. Yeah, you're going to go marry this guy, but your allegiance is to me. You're going to give me all kinds of information, and we're going to work this thing out. It doesn't work that way, though. Notice how the verse ends. She shall not stand with him or before him. She marries Ptolemy Epiphanes, and he ends up winning her loyalty. She ends up being loyal and having and giving her affection to him. And I know these quotes are hard to listen to, but please bear with me. I'd like to read you this one. Listen to what happens. Cleopatra herself affected more the cause of her husband than of her father, insomuch that she joined with her husband, this is Ptolemy now, the enemy of her father, she joins with her husband in an embassy to the Romans to congratulate them upon their victories over her father. Because Antiochus is going to go over there and he's going to get beat real badly. He's going to do well for a while, but he's going to get beat real badly by the Romans. She goes with him to congratulate the Romans and to exhort them, after they had expelled her father out of Greece, to prosecute the war in Asia, assuring them at the same time that the king and queen of Egypt would readily obey the commands of the Senate. So, not only did she was not on board with her dad at all. If he had any hopes of manipulating things down south through his daughter, it did not work out ultimately. We got 7 minutes left, Tom.
Quick question. The end of 16, what do you make that phrase sum up? Which by his hand shall be consumed in the kingdom?
Yeah. The Young's literal says, it is wholly in his hand. ASV, in his hand shall be destruction. The other translations seem to convey the idea that not that he does consume, but that he has the power to consume. It's there in his hand, showing his authority. That if I have the power to consume someone, I have authority there. Okay, I promised you a little bit of time on the 1290 and 1335. I should have given myself a little more time. It got away from me. Let's go over to the end of chapter 12. What I'm about to share with you does in no way originate with me. But it is interesting. And you can see what you think. We're going to have to hurry through this. I guess there's a number of things I'm going to skip just so we can get to the meat of the matter. We talked about the day for year theory principle. And talked about how the time, times, and half the time in chapter 7, verse 25 may have run from 533 to 1793. And that's 1260 days. Prophetic date, if we're understanding that right. Now, here at the end of the book of Daniel, we have some rather mysterious things said. Verse 11, Daniel is told right here at the end, from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. And then he says, blessed is he who waits, and comes to the 1,335 days. Now this is very cryptic. At least you can make it so. When you read that phrase in verse 11, from the time the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation, what does that make you think of? Well, that's true. Yeah, it makes you just think of the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24. That's right. What abomination of desolation came before Jerusalem's destruction in 70 A.D.? Yeah, and what Antiochus Epiphanes did, which has already been talked about in this book. So, that may be the primary fulfillment of these dates. That for 3.5 years, thereabouts, the daily sacrifice was taken away. The 1290 may be a more accurate and exact expression. The 1335 may lead you up to the time Antiochus dies. That could be the primary, the initial fulfillment. But when we saw a time period in the 8th chapter about Antiochus, when the time period was mentioned, it was 2300 what?
Evening morning.
They didn't use that word yom. Yom is being used here. And if we're going to be consistent, if we're going to say that the day is a day for a year in other places, then it seems like maybe we should apply that here as well. So that raises the question, if this is right for the 1260, then what are these dates about? And if these dates are applying to this, we do have to spiritualize what verse 11 says. The daily sacrifice being taken away and the abomination of desolation may pertain to the church going into hiding, going into the wilderness, the true church of God being obscured by the work of the papacy, the abomination of desolation perhaps being the papacy itself. It's a possibility. So starting in 533, if this is spiritually speaking, when the abomination of desolation is set up and when the daily sacrifice is taken away in a spiritual form, 1290 puts us at 1823 and 1335 puts us at 1868. Did anything happen in those dates that might match up with this prophecy? Well, let me share with you some thoughts and you make your decision. And by the way, you could understand these three dates to just be the gradual disintegration of the papal power. We saw the power broken over here at the French Revolution, but it's not completely taken away. The Pope gradually, though, does lose power, and I think these dates, at least to some extent, match up with that. In 1823, we come to the election of Pope Leo XII. Pope Leo XII. His pontificate actually began on my birthday, September 28, not 1823, but September 28. Now, Pope Leo XII. I've aged well. Now, after saying Leo XII, hold that thought and let's back up for a moment to his predecessor. Because to appreciate what happens in Leo XII's pontificate, we maybe need to appreciate what had happened in his predecessor's pontificate. The predecessor to Leo XII was Pius VII, P-I-U-S, the 7th, Pius VII. Pius VII is the Pope that Napoleon takes the crown out of his hands. He's that one. He gets called all the way over there. He's advised not to do it, but he goes that 1,000 miles and gets ready to do what popes have been doing for 1,000 years, and Napoleon takes the crown out of his hands. And thus it's shown here that the authority these men used to hold is no longer regarded. And Napoleon was hard on popes. In the course of 10 years, Napoleon deposes 2 popes and drives them both out of Rome. Now, that's not something that would have happened in time past, at least, well, there may be some exceptions to that, but that had not by any stretch of the imagination been the general rule. Napoleon was exercising power over the popes with quite a bit of freedom. Pope Pius would not go along with some of Napoleon's plans. Napoleon has him arrested, has him interned in virtual isolation, and even when he, and then when remember when, Napoleon finally gets sent to Elba. He gets cast out. He's sent to Elba. And Pope Pius is like, oh, he can go back to Rome now. So he goes back to Rome. But what happens? Napoleon gets out and he gets back in. And Pius is like, I got to get out of here. In 1815, Napoleon escapes. And he gets out. And then the 100 days ensues. During this pontificate, during this period, J.N.D. Kelly, and his book's right here. It's called The Oxford Dictionary of Popes. It is a very interesting book. He says that during Pope Pius VII's pontificate, the church was everywhere in disarray. And that Pope Pius VII made a real attempt, quote, to adapt the papacy within limits to the modern world. You hear that? Adapt the papacy to the modern world. Now, this is Leo XII's predecessor. Enter 1823. Leo XII comes to power. He's elected by conservatives who want to focus on the religious rather than the political orientation of the papacy. This is what they want. Let's stop focusing on the political power that the Pope has exerted in time past. Let's focus on religious power. And J.N.D. Kelly points out the guiding theme of Pope Leo's pontificate was not politics, but religious renewal. He would collaborate with sovereigns, but when he battled against things wrong in the faith as he understood it, he did it not through military action. He did do it through political channels. For a time, Leo was suggesting that the papacy as the spiritual leader of humanity should cease to rely on political action. Now think about that. The Pope, for 1,000 years, they had been crowning kings. They were kings. They had the papal states. And at this point now, we have a Pope who's drawing attention away from politics. And he's saying, let's focus on religious matters. He was a profoundly unpopular pope. And what Pope Pius IX had already said, okay, the Holy See, as they call it, we're neutral in affairs toward political changes. But Pope Leo XII now, coming in 1823, he takes it a step or two further. He starts taking this political disengagement to a much higher level. And that might be one of these steps here, that we see political power taken away in 1793. We see more power taken away with the man who assumed the pontificate in 1823. And then in 1868, our time's up. Do I keep going? Okay. All right. This won't be long. 1868, Pope Pius IX is Pope. That's not when he begins his pontificate, I don't think, but he is Pope in that time. Pope Pius IX may be the most important Pope in modern history. He ruled longer than any Pope ever has. He ruled from 1846 to 1878. Pius IX was a very religious man, but he was politically inept. And he was the Pope in 1868. And interestingly, Pius IX was the last Pope king. We don't think of popes that way, but that's what they were. They were kings. They had regions called the Papal States. This was their territory. He was a king in his little world. I mean, the Vatican's still like that today. I mean, they have their own currency. They have their own postal system. But this was on a broader level before 1868. But by 1860, Pope Pius had seen all his dominions, with the exception of Rome and the environs around it, annexed to the new kingdom of Italy. Italy's a relatively new affair. Italy was established March 17, 1861. Prior to that date, Italy was an idea, it was a peninsula, but it was not a country. Simultaneous with the Pope's declining authority now, he desires greater religious authority. And what is it that comes in the late 19th century? What doctrine of the Catholic faith? Papal infallibility. And on June 29th, 1868, Pope Pius IX calls for the First Vatican Council. Now, it won't begin till the following year, but the official call goes out. He wants to have, at least the call is made. I don't know exactly how all that works, who officially makes the call. I'm sure he's involved on some level. But the official call is made in 1868 for the First Vatican Council. And there's basically one reason for the Vatican Council, this First Vatican Council, and that is for papal infallibility. Pope Pius IX, based on the source that I have encountered, wanted to be declared infallible all the time. Now, they weren't willing to give him that. They gave him infallibility when he speaks ex cathedra, when he speaks from the chair on matters of faith and morals. The infallibility is not actually decreed until 1870, but this year is when it's called to have the Vatican Council to make it happen. Now, bear with me just a moment longer. When the First Vatican Council is called, the French are in Rome. The Italians, Italy has, I mean, they've got, the French are in Rome, and they are there to help the Pope. There's a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment in Europe. And they tell him, they're helping him in Rome, but they tell him, if you get infallibility declared, we're out of here. And they followed through on that. When papal infallibility is declared in 1870, the French leave, and Italian forces on September 20th, 1870, move in, occupy Rome, ending the temporal power of the Pope. He had a little bit of Rome. He has that no more. In 1870, they move into Rome and occupy it. On October 1870, Rome is incorporated into the Italian state, and from that time forward, Pope Pius IX never sets foot outside the area of the Vatican. He calls himself a prisoner of the Vatican, and for 59 years, no pope steps outside the Vatican. Not because they can't, but because they won't. They're sending a message. But it's interesting. It was in 1868 that the call was made that triggered the events that would end the Pope's temporal rule. And one quote from J.N.D. Kelly. He's an Anglican. He writes, well, I'll say this and then I'll give you the quote. Pope Pius IX ruled longer than any other pope. And then remember, quote, when he died, he had effectively created the modern papacy, stripped, as he never ceased to deplore, of its temporal dominion. It is sometimes said that modern Italy was founded over the dead body of Pope Pius IX. So, I don't know, but it maybe just a little piece of information to incorporate into your thinking and do with it what you think is appropriate. I appreciate the opportunity to have participated in the meeting. I appreciate all of your kind forbearance and mercy when I seemed a little bit out of my element. And I hope it's been edifying for you, and I regret that I was not able to be here for more of it. I guess I'll give the floor to the eldership.